With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's get started with some tunes.
With stars, two lovers in the dark on the run from the one that they call share spark. Six guns by the side and bullets round their waist. Two shots to the sky, signal sign for the chase. The safe was nearly empty and they were nearly free, but was seen by the good eye, the mean Billy Queen. And he screamed at the top of his lungs, they're on the run. It's the two outsiders, grab your horses and your guns.
I said I wish that we could stay here, but I fear our time has come. Chasing the rising sun. We gotta pack our bags this instant. We're heading southbound to the next town. And if we arrive there so safely, baby, you can lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down.
Well, it's the story of the two. Always on the move, they got nothing left to lose except their guns and their wounds. Now they're crossing border sheriffs, posse on their tail. They'd rather die together than be stuck up in a cell. They drank up all the whiskey and they partied every night, like it could be the last the bounty said to shoot on sight. So they chased the endless slumber, knew it came with the bright. They wouldn't stop running till they found a paradise. But the sheriff finally found them with the sight seeing red. So the lovers had to shoot them down and fill them full of lead. They were finally free to find a place to lay their head. Finally did, he looked at her and he said,
I said I think that we can stay here, cause I feel our time has come. And we can walk down to the ocean and sit with the rising sun. So unpack your bags this instant, no more running from town to town. And now that we've arrived so safely,
wipe the dirt off or take your shirt off, and we should go hit the cantina, we got work off. I said it's hot outside, let me go swimming in your eyes. We've been running for a while, want you lay down, make me smile. I could never ask for nothing better than this. It's just tequila and the beach, it's quite salty when we kiss.
I said I think that we can stay here, cause I feel our time has come. And we can walk down to the ocean and sit with the rising sun. No more running from town to town. And now that we've arrived so safely, baby, you can lay me down. Lay me down. Lay me down. No, lay me down. Lay me down.
Well, hello, and it's time for the Earth and Environment Science News for this week. Scientists have found another reason why the northeastern parts of Asia and North America are so chilly in the winter, much colder than the same latitudes in Europe. Until now, researchers have blamed this observation on the interaction of weather systems and mountain ranges and on the lack of a nearby ocean that could warm things via westerly winds. But in the March 31st issue of Nature, Caltech researchers say they've spotted large-scale waves in the atmosphere that suck cold northern air over the eastern parts of the continents. And air pollution shrinks newborns? Well, a woman's exposure during pregnancy to nitrogen dioxide, a gaseous pollutant emitted by traffic and industrial smokestacks, can diminish a newborn's size, a Spanish study finds. Scientists monitored the air pollution exposure of more than 2,000 pregnant Spanish women and identified NO2 as a major risk. For every 10 microgram per cubic meter increase in NO2 exposure, a baby's birth length was on average about 1 millimeter shorter. That tiny change boosted by 1.7% a baby's risk of being unhealthily small for gestational age. The scientists reported this online in the March 23rd issue of Environmental Health Perspectives. And do you remember the 2010 Russian heat wave and it was such a surprise to everybody? Well, last year, Western Russia experienced its warmest July since 1880, with many regions setting all-time highs. But there's no evidence that the crop withering heat can be blamed on global warming, reported university and federal scientists in Boulder, Colorado. They used computer programs to analyze interactions between greenhouse gas concentrations, sea surface temperatures, and sea ice conditions for signs of slowly evolving climate warming. Their finding, reported online March 19th in Geophysical Research Letters. They said, quote, "The intense 2000 Russian heat wave was mainly due to natural internal atmospheric variability," unquote, not to human influences or slowly evolving oceanic factors. And is the Antarctic becoming green with grass? Will Antarctica be the next market for lawnmowers? Well, the rapid warming of the Antarctic has been a boon for two native plants as the temperature warms ancient peat decomposes into a nitrogen buffet for the Antarctic pearlwort, also known as Colobanthus quintensis, and the Antarctic hairgrass, also known as Dischampsia antarctica. Now, a study by British and Australian scientists suggests that one of those plants, the hairgrass, is able to absorb that nitrogen buffet up to 160 times faster than their mossy competitors. We think of the Antarctic as a land of snow and ice, but in summer on the Antarctic Peninsula and the islands surrounding the frozen center of the continent, the snow melts and many areas become green with mosses and two species of native flowering plant, said one of the authors of the study, Bangor University scientist Paul Hill, in a press release from the school. Now, recently, as global temperatures have increased, the Antarctic summers have become longer and warmer, and one of these flowering plants, the Antarctic hairgrass, has become increasingly widespread, Hill said. Mosses formerly dominated the 2% of Antarctica that can support plant life, but the polar regions, including the Antarctic, have warmed far faster than the rest of the planet during the last 50 years. Now the vascular plants are taking over. Plants need nitrogen to grow successfully in coastal Antarctica, and most of the nitrogen is locked in an organic matter of the soil, which has been slow to decompose in these cold conditions. This is now becoming more available as the temperature increases, says Davy Jones of the Bangor University, another author of the study published recently in Nature Climate Change. The researchers found that hairgrass acquires nitrogen through its roots as short chains of molecules or peptides produced early in protein composition. That allows the plants to acquire nitrogen over three times faster than if they had to wait for bacteria to break proteins down into amino acids, nitrates, or ammonium. Mosses just can't match nitrogen absorbing speed like that. Now, if you want to see more about this, you can check out that study in Nature Climate Change. And speaking of more species or less species, the lack of spare species leaves ecosystems flat. Now, having backup plans and built-in redundancy features can save lives, whether it's emergency flares in the trunk of the car or warning lights and alarms in the cockpit of an airplane. For Earth, though, failures in redundancy can lead to catastrophe. In nature, multiple species compete for the same resources, something called ecological redundancy. For example, several species of sharks may feed on the same prey fish. If one species disappeared, the other sharks would take up the slack on chowing down the extra fish, keeping the system in balance. But if multiple species of shark go extinct, a situation that is currently playing out, the system can veer toward collapse. For the first time, researchers have made a direct connection between loss of redundancy and ecosystem collapse. Their work, published recently at the very beginning of the year in the journal Geology, shows that during extinction events in the Permian and Triassic periods, the Earth's ancient oceans lost critical backup species. Now, the research holds a dire warning about human activities in the oceans and points out the importance of preserving whole ecosystems, not just individual species. It's definitely a cautionary tale because we know it's happened at least twice before, said Jessica Whiteside of Brown University, the paper's lead author, in a press release. And you have long periods of time before you have reestablishment of ecological redundancy. Now, in these cases, it took 10 million years for nature to balance itself out again, the team reported. Many marine biologists worry that fisheries worldwide are in collapse right now. Overfishing of predatory species like bluefin tuna, sharks, and swordfish has eliminated not just competing species, but entire levels of the food chain. It is difficult to evaluate what is going on at present, given that we don't have the advantage of the long lens of geologic history, where we can see things play out over millions of years, Whiteside wrote in an email to Discovery News. But there's evidence that trophic, meaning food web, collapse is starting to occur in some marine ecosystems. One example of ecosystem collapse in the modern world can be seen off the coast of North Carolina, Whiteside said. The disappearance of the black-tipped shark, which we've talked about right on this show, have allowed the cow-nose ray population to explode. This event, called a trophic cascade, collapsed the area's century-old bay scallop industry. Similar situations occurred 250 and 200 million years ago. Predators similar to the modern-day nautilus, called ammonites, were once common and diverse, but many species went extinct after massive volcanic eruptions in the Permian and Triassic caused devastation and atmospheric disruption. The resulting climate change reduced ammonites to only a few species. Now, the result was a simplified food chain. A few hardy species survived the extinctions and became common. Generalist species expanded and filled wide ranges of the food web as opposed to locally adapted species filling specific niches. Other research has suggested that homogeneous populations of generalist species can actually slow the divergence of new species and subsequently the ecosystem's recovery. After the ancient extinctions, biodiversity and robust ecosystems slowly reemerged. To understand this reemergence, the ammonite researchers analyzed carbon isotopes in the fossils. The scientists were then able to measure the stability of the carbon cycle in the ancient oceans. Disruptions like the volcanic events of the Permian and Triassic caused species numbers to plummet. Now, after disturbances, it took up to 10 million years for fluctuations to settle down and a stable pattern to develop. Highest species diversities of ammonites were found when the carbon isotope values were stable. The take-home message is that biodiversity matters, Whiteside told Discovery News, and not just because it was nice to look at a bunch of species, she said, but because ecosystem functioning is reduced by biodiversity loss. So you might be asking, how does this climate change affect me? The top three American health threats from climate change, don't want to scare the heck out of you, but here it is. Within 30 years, the United States could be seeing serious health threats resulting from climate change, according to scientists speaking at an American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting on February 19th. Now, three studies were presented that examined the dangers that changes in ocean and freshwater environments could cause to people. The studies were funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Understanding climate change on a local level and what it means to county beach managers or water quality safety managers has been a struggle, said Julie Trindinge, the director of NOAA's Ocean and Human Health Initiative, in an NOAA release. Now, these cities and models enable managers to better cope and prepare for real and anticipated changes in their cities and keep their citizens, seafood, and economy safe, she said. Now, toxic algae blooms or red tides caused by the species Alexandrium canonella could last longer. That means more risk to humans of poisoning from contaminated shellfish, according to researchers at the NOAA and the University of Washington. Changes in the harmful algal bloom season appear to be imminent, and we expect a significant increase in Puget Sound and similar at-risk environments within 30 years, possibly the next decade, said Stephanie Moore of NOAA in a news release by that organization. Our projections indicate that by the end of the 21st century, blooms may begin up to 2 months earlier in the year and persist for 1 month later compared to the present-day time period of July to October, she said. Saxitoxin, a poison that is released by the red tide, accumulates in shellfish. If a person eats contaminated shellfish, they could suffer vomiting, muscle paralysis, and even death. Now, more of the world dries out here and deserts expand, wind may pick up more dust into the atmosphere. Iron in that dust may fuel the growth of harmful bacteria in the ocean. Researchers at the University of Georgia presented evidence that an increased amount of dust from West Africa blowing into the oceans fuels a population boom in Vibrio bacteria, a group of bacteria that can cause gastroenteritis and infectious disease in people. Within 24 hours of mixing weathered desert dust from Morocco and seawater samples, we saw a 10,000-fold growth in Vibrios, including one strain that could cause eye, ear, and open wound infections, and another strain that could cause cholera, said Aaron Lipp of the University of Georgia in an NOAA news release. Our next round of experiments will examine the response of the strains associated with seafood-related infections, Lipp said. Now, wetter Wisconsin's water, boy, Wisconsin sure has been in the news lately for all kinds of stuff. But last year was the wettest year on record, according to NOAA's Global Historic Climatology Network. Wisconsin, in particular, had its wettest year ever, and the climate change predictions say it's going to get even soggier. Oh no! Sewer systems weren't built to handle all that water. The last 10 years have seen more severe storms causing sewer overflows. Now, Sandra McClellan and her colleagues at the University of Wisconsin use climate models to predict that spring rains in Wisconsin are likely to increase over the next 50 years. That's bad news for sewer systems. Under worst-case scenarios, an average 20% increase in the volume of overflows is possible, and those overflows will last longer. Hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on urban infrastructure, and these investments need to be directed to problems that have the largest impact on our water quality, said McClellan. Our research can shed light on this dilemma for cities with aging sewer systems throughout the Great Lakes and even around the world. So you can check out NOAA, and they have all the updates on their research. And speaking of the environment, the Japanese nuclear engineers are plugging the Fukushima leak. Engineers battling to contain the crisis at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant appeared to have turned an important corner last night after they stopped highly radioactive water from leaking into the ocean from one of the facility's crippled reactors. Workers struggling to halt the leaks, and by the way, those workers are total heroes in my opinion, for staying there. It's just incredible. I can't even wrap my mind around it. But they have been struggling to halt those leaks successfully this time and used a mixture of sawdust, newspaper, concrete, and a type of liquid glass to stem the flow of contaminated water near a seaside pit, said the plant's owner, Tokyo Electric Power Company, also known as TEPCO. Now, earlier efforts involved cement, an absorbent polymer, and rags were unsuccessful in plugging the leak, which was discovered on Saturday, while radiation of more than 7.5 million times the legal limit for seawater was found just off the earthquake-hit plant. Now, in a sign of TEPCO's desperation, it breached its own regulations on Monday by beginning an intentional discharge of 11,500 tons of less contaminated water into the Pacific to make space for the highly radioactive liquid that was seeping out in an uncontrolled manner. The company still needs to pump contaminated water into the sea because of a lack of storage space at the plant and will continue to release the 11,500 tons of low-level radioactive water until Friday. The leaks were slowed yesterday after we injected a mixture of liquid glass and a hardening agent that has now stopped, a TEPCO spokesman told Reuters. This 9.8 magnitude earthquake and tsunami hit Japan's northeast coast, in case you've been living under a rock, on 11th of March, leaving 28,000 people dead or missing and thousands homeless. It is the country's worst catastrophe since the Second World War. Samples of the water used to cool the plant's reactor number 2 were emitting 5 million times the legal limit of radioactivity, officials said on Tuesday, adding to fears that contaminants had spread far beyond the disaster zone. Workers are still struggling to restart cooling pumps, which recycle the water in 4 reactors damaged by the earthquake and tsunami. Until those are fixed, they must pump the water from outside to prevent overheating and meltdowns. And in the process, that creates more contaminated water, so it has to be pumped out and stored somewhere else or released into the sea. The government is considering restrictions on seafood for the first time after contaminated fish were found. India is the first country to ban food imports from all areas of Japan over radiation fears. TEPCO has offered, quote, condolence money, unquote, to those affected in the Fukushima region, but one city rejected the compensation, and local mayors who came to Tokyo to meet the Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, demanded greater assistance. We have borne the risks, coexisted and flourished with TEPCO for more than 40 years, and all these years we have fully trusted the myth that nuclear plants were absolutely safe, said Katsuya Endo, the mayor of Tomioka. He was one of 8 Fukushima prefecture mayors seeking compensation and support for employment, housing, and education for the tens of thousands of evacuees. A total of 60,000 tons of highly contaminated water remains in the plant after workers poured this in seawater when fuel rods experienced partial meltdown after the earthquake and tsunami hit on March 11th. And now for a little music break.
Your children, they're too fat to feed. You're on medication, taking pills to sleep. I think I'm doing just fine compared to what you've been doing. I won't get vaccinated, insurance costs too much. I think you're so persuasive, but I'm not giving up. Saving my life, it's not what you're doing. I won't justify the way I live my life. Cause I'm the one living it, feeling it, tasting it, and you're just wasting your time trying to throw me a line. When you're the one drowning, I like where I'm at, on my back, floating down in my own riptide. The water is mine.
And some human science news. Don't worry, buy happy. What? That's kind of the opposite of what we've heard, but studies find that money buys less happiness than most people think, and that's because people don't spend it right, according to psychological research that provides 8 principles for getting a spending buzz that often go ignored. This is according to psychologist Elizabeth Dunn of the University of British Columbia and her colleagues. In an upcoming Journal of Consumer Psychology, Dunn's team recommends the following: buy more experiences and fewer goods, spend on others, focus purchases on small pleasures, buy less insurance, pay first and consume later, assess the daily impact of major purchases, avoid comparison shopping, and pay attention to purchases that make others happy. And kids arguing, well, isn't that pretty much normal? Well, there's a kids' argument clinic. Preteens can be taught to argue better, and that's a good thing, really. Kids who take twice-weekly classes from 6th to 8th grade in which they research and debate different sides of controversial public issues develop reasoning skills central to critical thinking and effective arguing, say psychologists Deanna Kuhn and Amanda Kroll of Columbia University in New York City. Unlike their peers, these youngsters increasingly considered opposing views, sought supporting evidence, and tried to integrate perspectives when writing essays about controversies such as whether teachers should get raises according to merit or seniority. And the researchers' report can be found in an upcoming issue of Psychological Science. And why do gifts go wrong? Speaking of gifts, in that first report, regifting is no fluke. Gift getters appreciate presents that they explicitly request more than surprises, whereas gift givers assume that solicited and unsolicited offerings will be equally valued, say Harvard economist Francesca Gino and Stanford business professor Francis Flynn. In surveys about wedding gifts, birthday presents, and Amazon.com wish lists, gift givers typically thought that unrequested gifts would be considered more thoughtful by recipients than was actually the case. Yeah, some surprises are real surprises, I guess, and not so much fun. The researchers report in an upcoming Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, although givers assume that recipients frown on cash gifts, gift getters appreciated money more than a moderately priced gift from a wish list. Well, I guess there are two camps on that, and they can fight it out at Christmas or birthdays. Elusive tool insights. Well, human culture may depend on an early developing ability to learn about tools, not invent them. Although 4 to 7-year-olds easily use toy tools, the same youngsters surprisingly fizzle at concocting simple implements, finds a team led by psychologist Nicola Cutting of the University of Birmingham in England. Children usually couldn't figure out that they could bend a pipe cleaner into a hook to remove an object from a flask, or straighten a bent pipe cleaner to make it long enough to poke an item out of a tube. The researchers reported this in an upcoming Journal of Experimental Child Psychology. I wonder what that means. But I bet they can work their PlayStation controller just fine, right? And scientists are always trying to find ways to alleviate pain and suffering. They just found out that meditators can concentrate the hurt away. Now, if a tree falls on you in the forest while you're meditating, does it still hurt? Well, yes, it does. But maybe not quite as much as it would if you weren't meditating. Researchers from North Carolina and Wisconsin reported this in the April 6th issue of Journal of Neuroscience. Individuals who practice mindfulness, meditation, or samatha during a pain experiment reported much less discomfort than they did in earlier meditation-free sessions. Samatha, the team says, flips switches on or off in diverse regions of the brain underlying attention, expectation, and even the awareness of thoughts themselves. Getting hit by a tree limb will hurt, but it won't hurt everyone in the same way, says study co-author Robert Kogel, a neuroscientist at the Wake Forest University School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The conscious mind, which is informed by personal experience and context, is an expert at deciding which sensations to take note of and which to ignore. All the time we're hanging out, our brain is being bombarded with all sorts of information, he says, but we let it all go. Now, a falling tree is more jarring than the tickle of a forearm hair, but meditation may help people to similarly let ouch, and yowza, reflexes go. In this study, Coggle and his colleagues prodded 15 volunteers with a hot poker of sorts, whoa, then used MRI to watch their brains respond to the hot but humane torture. And this was voluntary, by the way. Subjects found that 49 degrees Celsius pulses on average 57% less unpleasant and 40% less intense while meditating as opposed to resting normally. Study co-author Fidel Zeidan, himself a meditation practitioner for over a decade, taught the newbie subjects mindfulness meditation. In just 4 20-minute sessions, the dilettantes got a crash course in how to focus their attention on breathing without becoming derailed by sore bottoms or anxious thoughts, which is actually kind of hard because when you first start, you know, if you don't have somebody, you know, directing you, it's a pretty hard thing to pick up. Speaking from personal experience, because you start thinking of things like, you know, your grocery list and, you know, does the dog need to be fed? All kinds of weird things creep into your head. Now, meditation, often associated with tranquility, in fact, lights up parts of the brain like a Christmas tree. The anterior insula, for instance, which lies in a deep fold on the side of the brain, has been associated with sensing heat, cold, and pain, shined bright in the meditation experiments. This region may also preside over the awareness of thoughts themselves, said Zeidan, a cognitive neuroscience also at Wake Forest. If you've ever suppressed a desire to honk your horn rudely in traffic, yeah. Every day, you may have your anterior insula to thank. The meditators were able to take a step back from their thoughts and look at them for what they were, he says. Part of the thalamus, on the other hand, flicked off during meditation. The thalamus filters the endless trains of sensory signals arriving to the brain from the body. Now, meditation could then ensure that fewer ouch-inducing signals reach the conscious mind in the first place. This study illustrates what a powerful pain reliever psychology can be, says Donald Price, who researches pain and the placebo effect at the University of Florida in Gainesville. In some cases, changing a patient's outlook on pain can be just as soothing as certain doses of morphine. But he admits most doctors and nurses don't have the time to turn the lights down low and lead meditation sessions. Rolling meditation into the hospital setting will take time, suggests Susan Smalley, director of Mindful Awareness Research Center at UCLA. Few studies, including this one, have looked at the health impacts of meditation using controlled clinical-style studies. Still, she hopes it's only a matter of time before meditation becomes a regular activity for most Americans. Few people, she notes, wore seatbelts when they first came on the market. Now everyone wears them, she says. I kind of think mindfulness and practices are like that are at the early stage. And, well, we are all for making life better for everybody, aren't we? And beer bugs and DNA are linked to stomach cancer, a genetic variant low-grade infection, and guzzling beer can add up to trouble. Swilling at least 3 beers a day over several years can increase a person's risk of stomach cancer if combined with 2 other unseen risk factors researchers have found. But oddly, wine and liquor didn't show the same danger level for this malignancy, the team reported April 4th at a meeting of the American Association for Cancer Research. The triple threat includes carrying 2 copies of RS1230025, a gene variant located amid a cluster of genes associated with degrading alcohol in the body. A third risk factor is an infection with Helicobacter pylori, which is a well-known bacterium that causes stomach cancer and ulcers, which is the most common knowledge of this particular bacterium. H. pylori infection is uncommon in the U.S., but roughly half the world's populations carry this microbe. Eric Duhl, an epidemiologist at the Catalan Institute of Oncology in Barcelona, and his colleagues analyzed data on health status and alcohol intake among thousands of adults participating in a European study between 1992 and 1995. The researchers found a broad link between stomach cancer and drinking 3 or more beers a day, but no clear association for similar amounts of wine or liquor, which was kind of, that's a little surprising. The researchers then focused on 364 people who had been diagnosed with stomach cancer and 1,272 others without cancer to test the combined effects of beer intake and having the variant gene. People who drank 3 beers or more daily showed a slight increase in stomach cancer risk if they carried 1 copy of the gene variant compared to similar drinkers without the variant. Also, very modest drinkers who carried 2 copies of the variant had a slightly increased risk over similar drinkers without it. But those with high beer intake who also carried 2 copies of the variant gene had a 3 to 22-fold increase in stomach cancer risk compared with heavy drinkers who didn't carry a variant copy. Now, nearly all people with stomach cancer had H. pylori infections. That's interesting, which the researchers took into account in calculating risk differences. But 3 risk factors all appear necessary for the heightened risk, but the direct cancer-causing event is probably inflammation, Duell says. Many lines of research have linked inflammation with increased cancer risk, and the triple whammy cited the new study would boost chronic gastritis or stomach inflammation, he says. Now, it all makes psychological sense. Physiological sense, says George Kim, a gastrointestinal oncologist at the Mayo Clinic, Florida, in Jacksonville, who was not part of this study. If you cut off the enzymes that break down alcohol, then that causes problems over time. Throw in H. pylori, and that's another hit, he says. About 20% of people carry at least 1 copy of the variant form of the gene, Duell says. Now, meanwhile, it remains unclear which compounds found in beer might account for the different risk found between it and other alcoholic beverages, he says. The U.S. has low rates of stomach cancer because of its dearth of H. pylori, Kim says now. The disease remains the second leading cause of cancer death worldwide after lung cancer, suggesting genetic screening would have value, he continued. So if you want to know more about this, you can check out that report from the American Association for Cancer Research website, because it is posted right on there. And a new scientific breakthrough that would turn cannabis into the new aspirin. Yes, I said cannabis. That cannabis. Yesterday, scientists announced that they discovered a way to harness the pain-killing powers of the active ingredient in marijuana, THC, while eliminating the high. What this means is that a special, non-hallucinatory version of THC could become the new aspirin. Physiologist Li Zhang and colleagues discovered that THC targets several parts of the nervous system, some of which are called inhibitory glycine receptors, or GLIRs. These receptors, according to Zhang, help regulate, quote, neuromotor activity, pain sensation, muscle relaxation, and anxiety, unquote. He and his fellow researchers speculate that a synthetic THC could be made that targets just GLIRs, hence a form of cannabis that works as a painkiller but does not get you high. And the researchers wrote this yesterday in an article published in Nature Chemical Biology, quote, cannabis is comprised of more than 400 chemical components, and under these components are found to provide therapeutic relief in alleviating chronic pain, seizure, depression, and muscle spasms resulting from multiple sclerosis. But the primary psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, THC, produces some unwanted effects on human health, such as motor impairment. Zhang and colleagues want to eliminate these unwanted effects so that they can create new kinds of pain medication. Soon, people whose stomachs are too tender for aspirin or ibuprofen may be swallowing THC pills to get rid of headaches. Non-psychotropic cannabinoids is a technical term for the drug Zhang and colleagues are seeking. This is great news for people who want to use medical marijuana, but it leaves the recreational users asking just one question. Is there a way to create a synthetic form of THC that does nothing but get you high without all those pesky medicinal side effects? Okay, we're not going to go into that that question right now, but you can read this full scientific paper in Nature Chemical Biology. And research shows adult brains capable of rapid new growth. Believe it or not, I guess you can't teach an old dog new tricks. In a paper published in Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, Veronica Kwok, Li-Ai Tan, and their colleagues at the University of Hong Kong conclude that the adult human brain is capable of new rapid growth when exposed to stimuli similar to what babies experience as they are learning from their environment. That's very interesting. The research subjected 19 adult volunteers to a study where colored cards, two shades of green and two blue, were shown to them, each with nonsensical names. The participants were then asked to accept new words as actual descriptors for the new colors and memorize them so they could reply with the correct color name at a later date and to match them when asked. After the conditioning was carried out over 3 days with 5 sessions, total time less than 2 hours, the subjects all underwent MRI scans where it was revealed that new gray matter had formed in the left hemisphere of their brains. Now that's exciting. But it's not clear yet if the new matter was comprised of new neuron formation or if they were simply dendrites, which are branches. Previous research has shown that new brain growth is possible over periods of time, but until now it was thought that the human brain was incapable of adding gray matter over such a short period of time. It appears the key lies in the name differentiation and how the subjects perceive the colors based on the names that were given, something much deeper than, say, asking subjects to simply memorize a list of names. I guess they have to have association involved. It was a change in perception. This is backed up by the fact that the areas of the brain that grew new matter were parts of the brain known to process color and vision, but more importantly, perception. The researchers were surprised by the findings as they'd set out to find answers to the long-standing question of whether people come to perceive the world in certain ways depending on which language they happen to speak. Though they may not have solved that particular riddle, the results of their research may one day lead to new ways to help people with learning disabilities or perhaps even those with brain damage. And you can find out more about this. Learning new color names produces rapid increase in gray matter in the intact adult human cortex is the name of it in the PNAS published online before print April 4th, 2011. And the bionic eye is seen closer to reality. Yes, science fiction is science fact once again. Australian researchers at Bionic Vision Australia have brought new microchip technology a step closer to actually implanting its wide-view bionic eye into a patient. The research team led by Australian neuroscientist and medical engineer Greg Sonning, University of South Wales, he hails from, is preparing for the first patient test of its wide-view bionic eye. Dr. Sonning states, quote, "This is a remarkable new microchip that has brought an Australian retinal implant much closer to reality." He adds, "At only 5 square millimeters, the device is tiny, but represents a significant advance in nerve stimulation and technology. It has 98 precisely controlled stimulation channels and numerous features that allow for the delivery of electrical stimulation that can restore some sense of vision." That research team at Bionic Vision Australia hopes to have a bionic eye in operation so that vision-impaired people can better see and function in this world. A microchip within the wide-view bionic system, its bionic eye, so to speak, stimulates the retinal cells to produce vision. The bionic eye system being developed by the Australian team consists of a camera, which is attached to a pair of glasses. The camera receives images and sends them to a processing unit that is worn by the user. A wireless transmitter then sends the data to a microchip in the retinal implant. Further, the microchip decodes this data and produces the electrical stimulation in the retina. These signals are then sent along the optic nerve to the brain where they are interpreted as sight. Now, tests at Bionic Vision Australia will continue through 2013 with the first implant of the Bionic Vision system expected sometime that same year. The March 31, 2011 media release called Microchip Brings Bionic Eye Closer to Human Trials, unquote, from Bionic Vision Australia concludes with, quote, "This is good news for people who experience progressive vision loss due to retinitis pigmentosa, RP, which is a very big deal, and age-related macular degeneration, AMD. RP affects 1.5 million people around the world, while AMD is responsible for almost half of all legal blindness in Australia. And, another quote, bionic vision technology aims to restore some sense of vision to people affected by these degenerative conditions so they can regain their mobility and independence, unquote. Bionic Vision Australia is an Australian consortium consisting of the Bionic Ear Institute, Centre for Eye Research Australia, NICTA, formerly National ICT Australia, and the University of Melbourne and the University of New South Wales. In addition, the Australian National University and University of Western Sydney are project partners. The Bionic Eye Research is funded by the Australian Research Council, or ARC. And if you want to see something really cool in biology and really weird, go to Scientific American. They have a video of the tentacled snake. It may be the strangest serpent you've ever heard of. It is, well, maybe not the strangest, one of the strangest that I've ever heard of. So named for the distinctive appendages that project from its snout. Now, this snake dwells in rivers and lakes in Southeast Asia, where it feeds on fish. Yeah, it's not in Australia. All the weird ones seem to be in Australia, but this one isn't. It's in Southeast Asia. Scientists have long pondered the purpose of these peculiar tentacles. Now, neurobiologist Kenneth C. Catania of Vanderbilt University decided to investigate. In doing so, he discovered that the snake uses surprisingly sophisticated tactics to catch fish, which he describes in an article in the April issue of Scientific American. But online, you can go look at the video. Ooh. Watch the snakes in action and see how they exploit neural circuitry in the fish that usually help the fish avoid predation. What about tentacles? Well, the video answers that question, too. Check it out. And speaking of water, humans, and really small things that are alive, which we have been all along on this show. Well, here's one that has everything in it. Future waters with algae implants could breathe underwater. No, it's not a comic book. This is actually true. Ever wonder how we're going to create humans who can breathe underwater? Well, of course you do. Some people even have dreams of this. And, of course, we've got Aquaman and all that sort of thing. Now, a study published this week about how algae insulate themselves into salamander embryos and DNA could provide the beginnings of an answer. Woo! We know that viruses can invade an organism and eventually wind up integrating into that organism's DNA permanently. Human DNA is packed with all the virus DNA we've absorbed over the past few hundred thousand years. But could other microbes do the same thing? Well, a group of biologists decided to find out, and by studying the relationship between algae and salamanders, they did just that. They knew that algae often snuck inside salamander embryos, but the question that nagged was, what happened next? Now, it seems likely that some salamanders are literally part algae. Now, this odd situation could be the foundation for biological tweaks that might help future post-humans living underwater. Man from Atlantis and woman from Atlantis and kids from Atlantis. Basically, it appears that algae sneak into developing salamander eggs and become part of the salamander fetus as it grows. And the algae doesn't leave either. Some adult salamanders have algae DNA, which they are likely passing on to the next generation. That's right, salamanders are part plant. According to a release from PNAS, the researchers report that algae, which may come into contact with developing salamanders when the eggs are laid in pools of water, enter the embryos before the development of the salamander's adaptive immune system. Previous studies have proposed that the adaptive immune system prevents intracellular symbiosis between algae and vertebrate animals. Fewer algal cells were detected in later-stage salamander larvae. However, tests revealed that algal DNA in the reproductive tracts of some adults, which suggested to the researchers that algae may also directly transfer to salamander offspring from one generation to the next. And here's where things get interesting for those of us who look forward to the Homo sapiens aquatic bioexpansion pact. The likely reason why this half-plant, half-animal symbiotic relationship evolved was because the algae snacked on nitrogen in the embryo's waste, while the embryo benefited from the oxygen in the algae's waste. Okay, yes, they were both eating each other's poop, if you want to think of it that way. But more importantly, what it means is that the algae could be built-in source of oxygen for organisms it decides to pair with symbiotically. According to the authors of this study, we are now certain that algae can live within vertebrate tissues, which means, hey, why not in humans? We're vertebrates too, right? So the next time you're coming up with your mad scientist plan to design aquatic humans, consider algae implants. Sure, you need to do a lot of bioengineering first, but algae could prove to be the foundation of a redesigned human who needs help pulling oxygen from the water. Now, if you want to read more about this mutagenic creation, you can go to the current issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS, and check it out. Well, that about concludes this episode of Savage Science Radio, and I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the great show graphics and the fantastic intro that I use every single week by Dennis Baum and Hawk Productions, and also I'd like to thank my person who helps me with my research every single week, Waleed Al-Haddad. He's fantastic as well, and my executive producer, Todd Sheets, who's a miracle man at the technological aspect of this show. So if it sounds good, you can thank him. Anyway, I'd like to wish you all a wonderful week. Keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails until next we meet again.
This is heavy duty, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of the DeLorean?
Great Scott!